gentlemen, program cards for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium. Thank you.
Good evening, Raymond.
Evening, Tomas. This is the concert for me. Russian music and plenty of it. What I love about it, there's always something gripping about Russian music, whether it's a soft embrace or a listen-to-me headlock. It grabs you and you got to listen to it. I was very fortunate a couple of years ago to meet Valery Gergiev, the great Russian conductor. And he was explaining to me, he said, just bear in mind, Raymond, that, you know, the tradition which goes back many hundreds of years of classical music in Germany and Italy, it came quite late to Russia, relatively late, about 200 years ago. And I just marvel at the fact then that in a very short space of time, they basically made classical music their own. I would consider the 20th century to be the Russian classical music century. Just think about it. Rimsky-Korsakov, who we've got here tonight, Khachaturian, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff, Prokofiev. You can go on and on. And Tchaikovsky probably remains the best known of all of them. But there's a whole body of people there, including performers as well. Perhaps the most famous performer from the 20th century, Rostropovich. We've also got Vengerov, Anna Trebko as a singer, and of course Gergiev himself, who's blazed a trail around the world as one of the most mercurial of all conductors.
Well, I think we'll have to join issue on this. I can agree with you. I think that we are dealing with the Russian century. The 20th century is the Russian century of music, and to some extent maybe the late 19th century as well. But I do not think it's about Russia as such. I think that what we're looking at in Russian music at this period is basically the manifestation of huge political forces, huge political upheaval being manifest in classical music. And that's what makes this the most important classical music for anyone, for contemporary life, and probably the most important classical music ever. Because classical music up until this point is really, it's a backdrop. It's a tune in the background of the very wealthy. And it's something that people have as a very high-grade leisure. Whereas what we're dealing with in Russian classical music, and really when you get into the Soviet era even more so, we are dealing with music for the people. This was an era when, and it's a place and a time and space, and all of these people meant what they said about the music. The music meant something to them in their lives. It was something political. It had absolute meaning and reached out into their lives. I can't think of any other place and time in the world where you've got someone like Stalin, you know, sitting down there watching how a clarinet moves to see if there's any bourgeois sensibilities in the middle of it. This was classical music's life being lived very seriously indeed.
Absolutely, Tomas. I would agree with that. It came, certainly in the Soviet era, I think is really to clarify, in the Soviet era, it came right mainstream. It wasn't some, you know, lonely composer working away in his garret. This was somebody working under the heel of the, under the cosh of the Soviet authorities. I suppose the man who suffered most from that was probably Shostakovich. But music, it became a whole way of expressing national pride.
I would even go further and say that it's not just national pride, it's the construction of an entire political and philosophical mindset is seen within these works tonight and within classical Russian music, including the pre-Soviet era. And you can't really say that the Soviet era, they were working under the cosh of Stalin and they were pushing them towards a political objective, because both of the other people this evening, Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky, are both also working under very strong political leaders with very strong political ideology. And what you're looking at is, of course, the classical music came very late to Russia, came very late to the Tsarist Empire. It comes with the opening up of St. Petersburg and the idea of the influence of the rest of Western culture. And really, if you wanted to put a source point, you could say that the Napoleonic Wars really kickstarts classical music in Russia, because you've got these upper echelon, reasonably well-educated officer class and the minor nobles They go into Europe, they fight, they beat Napoleon, and then they're exposed to all of this culture, this beautiful music, this whole classical history. And up until then, Russia's been very inward-looking. The Tsarist Empire is inward-looking. It's all about folk music. It's all about, you know, the village community and their folkloric traditions. And suddenly, they're deciding they're going to have a classical conservatory, and they're going to have classical music brought into it. And then what happens is that there's a bit of a problem, and that is this thing called the Decembrist Revolt. And this is in about 1825. Some of these officers, and a lot of people who'd really experienced the joys of the West when they'd been there fighting Napoleon, and they came back and they said, we want this Western society. We'd like something approaching democracy, maybe even a tiny bit of restraint on the Tsarist sort of hand in Russia. That was ruthlessly crushed. And so from that point onwards, the Tsars begin to see any influence that's essentially Western as being decadent and dangerous and against them. So that when you are composing classical music like Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky, you've got to make sure that you've got a big dollop of Russian folklore in the middle of it.
I think you need to be careful, Tomas. It's just that, you know, Tchaikovsky studied, obviously, at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, which was very young at the time, and it's important to make the distinction that up until then, typically, a Russian classical music composer was self-taught. What's changing then, and the man who really straddled the change was Rimsky-Korsakov, who became a teacher there for a long time. What was changing then was that they were going to be classically trained, and I use the word classically in the Western sense, and Tchaikovsky was really the first person to do that. Interesting that he should study in St. Petersburg, which of course was built by Peter the Great, as the window into Russia from the West. And of course Tchaikovsky then used Western forms, orchestration, harmony and so forth in his music. And for the rest of his time, for the rest of his life, what you might call the people who held the moral high ground of classic Russian music, they kept Tchaikovsky at a certain distance because he had incorporated far too much of the Western classical means of composing, the orchestration, the harmonies and so forth. And even though, and you were quite rightly averred to that earlier, even though he included some of the Russian folkloric themes and so forth, he was always seen as being far too Western, even to the extent that, of course, he travelled an awful lot more. He was the first Russian composer to make a big hit in the West, and he travelled a lot. He, for instance, you know, in New York, the opening of Carnegie Hall, the man who conducted the opening concert in Carnegie Hall was Tchaikovsky.
It's very clear that Tchaikovsky was an absolute triumph from the perspective of the classical Western music tradition, and that he represents, therefore, the most insidiously dangerous kind of composer for the imperial Tsarist Russian Empire. Because here he is having a hit in the West. He's having many hits in the West. He's traveling in the West, and he's bringing back these corrupting influences, bringing back these ideas about democracy, about the idea of change within the community. And the Tsars had already gone as far as they were going to go in 1861, being the last place on planet Earth to emancipate their serfs. So we're looking at a tradition here of writing, and we're quite rightly suggesting that it's a classical music tradition and that they are being regarded suspiciously because of their Western influence. But the reason they're being regarded so suspiciously is because at just this period, they are finally releasing their serfs in Russia. And we can't imagine how important that was. Both Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky are in their 20s when this is going on. They will not have been blind to the fact that huge political influence from the West is underway. And so when they bring back this Western decadent music and they go to Carnegie Hall and bring back their Western decadent influence and success, they must know they're putting themselves in the firing line. The polar opposite to this Western tradition is Tsar Nicholas II's idea, the big idea, summarized in his three-word phrase, orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. Nationalism, which really encapsulated his ideas, which were Slavophilia.
Slavophilia? That sounds like a sex crime, Tomas. What's your language?
Well, it isn't a sex crime. It's actually a love of the Slavic people, which is the furthest from that you could possibly want. That Slavophilia can be seen tonight in Rimsky-Korsakov's The Tsar's Bride. The Tsar, in this particular case, is Ivan the Terrible. The story of The Tsar's Bride is the story of Ivan the Terrible picking a peasant woman as his Tsarina, and he elevates her entire family up to noble status. And this kind of idea that we can find the best within ourselves, we don't have to look to these Western people, and it doesn't really matter if you're a peasant, it rang very nicely at this time of turmoil for the serfs, and we can all be together as Slavs, and we can elevate you from wherever you are, and so we don't have to worry about changing the noble society that we have. Any serf can make it.
Well, Tomas, I'm glad you explained that to me, because obviously we only had the overture here this evening, which is a delightful piece of music, no doubt about it. And I've often pondered about, even when I was very young, I used to hear about the 1812 overture or the William Tell overture. And I used to wonder, like, these things were very frequently performed as standalone pieces. And of course, the reason being, which I now I'm aware of, is the fact that they were like the film trailer of today. They were all the bells and whistles, all the nice little bits out of the opera or whatever followed, which then maybe faded away as they became performance pieces in their own right. And of course, the other thing to bear in mind is that the overture gave the orchestra an opportunity to shine itself without, shall we say, in inverted commas, the distraction of stuff going on the stage above. So it was their opportunity to go for it, and by God, they often did go for it to make the impression, because, hey, folks, we're down here in the pit, you may not be able to see us, but we're playing our hearts out as well. Because once the opera starts up on the stage, everyone's attention goes up onto the stage, and that's the orchestra's one and only chance, shall we say, to make a statement. And I think they made it a good statement here tonight. That's a nice little piece. I mean, it's quite a short piece, but a nice piece.
Ladies and gentlemen, and the doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium.
Of course, it's been Tchaikovsky's week here at the National Concert Hall, and we've had Romeo and Juliet, we've had the Nutcracker, and really then we can justify having something a little lighter, although maybe not that light.
Not that light, no, you're quite right. Although it's worth reflecting, I think, Tomas, you mentioned there at Tchaikovsky week, there are very, very few composers to whom a whole week could be given over, as they've just done here. And you've got to ponder and say, well, why? Why Tchaikovsky? Now, from a technical point of view, people will say that there's great lyricism in his music, lovely melodies. You can go away humming his tunes afterwards. Lovely orchestration. Some people say, of course, that it may be too emotive. Certainly in his personal life, he did not wear his heart on his sleeve, but in his music, in many cases, he does wear his heart on his sleeve. But I have another addition to this. Is the Raymond Blake theory of enduring Tchaikovsky popularity, which runs parallel, not contradictory, runs parallel to what I've just said. And I say this much. Think about 8-year-old school children, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds. They get brought to see the Nutcracker. They get brought to see Swan Lake. They get brought to see Sleeping Beauty, a nice Christmas treat. And straight away, they're not bored by it. They sit there fascinated by the whole ballet, the movement, and the tunes, those gorgeous lyrical melodies, the sweeping string sounds. They just go in and they never come back out again. They just love it. They get to know Tchaikovsky long before they know Bach or Beethoven or Mozart. And then as 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, those things just come back again, again, and again. They're in their DNA, you might say. That, I believe, is the explanation for his enduring popularity.
What makes me sad when I listen to all that is that Tchaikovsky has been such an important influence, I can see it in you, for generations of people. He's been a huge educational figure. He's brought people into classical music. And I'm worried when I look at, you know, the events that are going on in Russia at the moment. You've got a minister like Medvedinsky suggesting that Tchaikovsky, they've got a film coming up that they're co-sponsoring about him, and they're going to just eliminate anything about his sexuality. They're just suggesting that he was in no way gay, that there was no homosexual aspect to his life at all. And on that basis, because it would be illegal to do otherwise, they've introduced a law that says if you have any positive portrayal of homosexuality or a homosexual person, then the whole thing is illegal. Now, that's going to be a huge constraint, and not just for musicians, but also for performers and even sports people at the Winter Olympics. And it's the kind of thing that you have to reflect before you start to work. And we won't want our artists reflecting on laws before they produce great work. We want them to just go out there and do that. And you see this as this is definitely a problematical thing. are we going to see more great Russian classical music when we've got this kind of repression afoot? Fortunately, Tchaikovsky didn't grow up in an era when he had these kind of laws, and he was able, you know, very much so, to take advantage of anybody who was interested in art without looking at who he was or what he was. And his great patron, indeed, von Meck, Madame von Meck, was a wonderful woman who didn't even want to meet him. They sent letters back and forward, and she sent the cash that kept him able to keep producing. And she had some very interesting things to say about music and sherry, indeed.
Sherry?
Yes, she in one of her letters she wrote and compared music to the tasting of a beautiful, fine sherry.
That sounds... You're on my sort of ground now, Tomas, where you need to ponder. What type of sherry was she talking about?
I wonder. An Oloroso? Is it deep and rich?
No. I'm thinking more along Amontillado, because if you think of it, the style of his music, it wasn't quite that strong. I think more Amontillado, although you may even go elsewhere. Palo Cortado?
Palo Cortado, something that has some sour, bitter undernotes. There's a bit of broodingness to it. It looks sweet on top, but it has a sour undertone.
But did Tchaikovsky agree with her assertion that listening to great music was like drinking a fine sherry?
I'm afraid he didn't, Raymond. Tchaikovsky believed that it was not a physiological phenomenon. And he wrote a very, very nasty little letter back to her saying it's not a physiological phenomenon, it's a truth-seeking thing, and that he felt that it was an intellectual process. But I think that just means that he didn't understand wine.
Spoken like a vodka drinker, I'd say.
Exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. All doors are now closing. Thank you.